answer session, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. Now I will turn the meeting over to Ms. Jennifer Simone. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is integrating freight in project selection. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have four presenters: Libby Ogard of Prime Focus, Richard Martinko of the University of Toledo, and Steve Devine and Catherine Chapani of the Rhode Island Department of Transportation. Prime Focus LLC was established in 2001 as a freight transportation consulting firm specializing in economic analysis, freight transportation research, freight policy issues, and transportation facility feasibility studies and public outreach. Libby Ogard is actively involved in the Transportation Research Forum, Transportation Research Board, Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals, and National Industrial Transportation League. She has spent 17 years in the railroad industry with Burlington Northern Railroad and Conrail. She spent 7 years at Schneider National Carriers and was general manager for the retail division responsible for Target, Family Dollar, Walgreens, Home Depot, and other accounts. She received her BA from Michigan State University and her MBA from University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. Rich Martinko has a comprehensive professional background that includes over 33 years of experience as an engineer and manager. He presently serves as the director of the University of Toledo's Intermodal Transportation Institute and the University Transportation Center, one of only 60 designated by the Federal Department of Transportation nationwide. He has extensive experience in both the public and private sectors, having held management positions in the manufacturing, consulting, and construction sectors. Most recently, before joining the University of Toledo, Rich served as the Assistant Director of Highway Operations for the Ohio Department of Transportation. He is a graduate of the University of Toledo, where he earned a BS in Civil Engineering, and in 2002 was named an Outstanding Civil Engineering Alumni. He has been a registered professional engineer in Ohio since 1978. Catherine Chapani has been the supervising planner for transportation at Rhode Island Statewide Planning for the last 7 years. She is originally from the state of Maine. She has a Bachelor of Science in Architecture from Penn State University and a Master of Community Planning from the University of Rhode Island. Prior to joining Statewide Planning, she worked for the Rhode Island Port Authority and the Economic Development Corporation for 7 years. Steve Devine is the chief of the Intermodal Planning Section for the Rhode Island Department of Transportation. He has been in this position since 2003. The Intermodal Planning Section is responsible for all of Rhode Island DOT's non-highway programs and projects, including Commuter Rail Program, Enhancement Program, CMAC, Bicycle and Pedestrian, Ferry Boat, and the Park and Ride Program. He also serves as project manager on the South County Commuter Rail Project, which is a 20-mile extension of MBTA service south of Providence. He's also project manager on the Warwick Intermodal Station Project, which is a $210 million consolidated intermodal transportation and rental car facility adjacent to TF Green Airport, and is project manager on Phase 2 of the South County Commuter Rail Extension Study, investigating other stations at Kingston, Westerly, East Greenwich, and Cranston. He began at Rhode Island DOT in 1987 as a planner on the state's Alternative Transportation and Rideshare Program. He holds a bachelor's degree in urban affairs with a concentration in city planning from the University of Rhode Island. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the smaller text box underneath the chat area on the right side of your screen. Please make sure you're typing in the thin text box and not the large white area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask the question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and a great forum for the distribution of information, as well as a place where you can post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you have not already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I'd again like to remind you that the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion of the seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next few weeks. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend this seminar to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used during today's seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online. I'll notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and a transcript of the seminar. So now we'll go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is integrating freight and project selection, and our first presentation will be given by Libby Ogard of Prime Focus LLC. As a reminder, if you have any questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they will be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. So with that, I will bring up your presentation, Libby, and you can get started.
All right. Well, thank you so much for inviting me today, and I'm glad that we've got so many people on the line today from a participation perspective. The project that we were assigned was identifying freight and integrating freight into the transportation planning process. As we approached the project, we were very aware that freight planning processes vary significantly by place, region, size, and the overall economy of a general area. So as we think about the complexity of our nation and the fact that ports may have a very different planning process than maybe inland or rural areas or places where there's a lot of urban congestion, that might be a very different planning challenge than someplace that's very rural and might struggle with even modal access types of issues. We went through the process and interviewed many different folks and identified through pretty extensive investigation how planning processes changed based on region, place, and size, and how the projects are identified through various different processes. We also looked at the project selection process, the use of tools and performance measures, and different funding, partnership strategies, and advocacy and outreach efforts. If we go to the next slide, the project was, I'm one slide off here. We identified the key challenges associated with this, and we went through the needs identification process. We identified seven different key freight elements in the planning process, and what we will do in the next several slides is go through each individual point in more detail. The first point is a technical lead, and one of the things that we identified in this process is the fact that a freight champion is exceptionally helpful. We also identified that there's a freight planning process continuum associated with many of the planning efforts. So while you might start a freight planning process with simply a single individual, as the maturity process increases and as you go down the freight planning process path, many times when you evolve into a more holistic planning process, the role of that freight champion will change. So in some of the interviews we identified, a freight champion might be an individual go-to person or a resource person that might be available to anybody within the MPO or the region, or might be available to anybody within the state DOT. That person often had to be a generalist and had to be fairly familiar with a broad variety of issues. But in some respects, as that person gained not only sort of the identification of being sort of the freight expert on staff, they also evolved into being more of a generalist and more available for folks that had questions about economic development, the impact of transportation on economic development, as well as specific engineering details, things like geometry, turning radius, stoplight, transportation flows. And in some respects, those people's roles evolved into more of an entrepreneurial role, trying to look at choke points and congestion points potentially as places where we might be able to look at different innovation and ways we might be able to look at things different in order to help alleviate choke points and congestion.
Understanding a regional freight system is also very important. Knowing where the freight nodes are, knowing what drives congestion at certain points, understanding whether you're dealing with a international trade problem or a domestic trade problem, or issues where information might get quote-unquote stuck in the planning process. So for example, some of the key elements that we looked at is how do we help people gain a firsthand understanding of exactly where some of the choke points and where some of the critical congestion issues are arising. And one of the areas that we found which was particularly instructive was Delaware Valley Regional Plan Commission actually instituted a program where they called it Freight for a Day. And they actually got several different volunteers across different organizations to go look at specific freight nodes and freight choke points. And that firsthand observation helped a number of people throughout different planning responsibilities within the different agencies understand exactly how the system was performing and how to potentially come up with methods to streamline freight and freight movement within a specific geography. The other thing that we identified in the study is at this point, most of these processes are a bottom-up process. So a lot of the information has to start at the lowest common level and then work its way up through the freight planning process to incorporate freight into more of a programmatic system. The key elements to this task or to understanding regional freight is what is the economic structure? Are you in a production point? Are you in a distribution point? Where does your location fit with respect to the trade infrastructure? Are you at an endpoint of a railroad or a midpoint of a railroad? Are you at an inland port location or a point where many modes or many lanes or corridors come together? What's the freight infrastructure there? Are you currently at capacity? Is there opportunity to expand capacity? And what are the different types of commodity and vehicle flows that might impact your region? Things like, are you dealing with surges of bulk materials, for example, grain during a harvesting period? Are you looking at retail, which might have stronger flows during the holiday season? And how are organization and public policy issues impacting your freight planning at that level? The next element that we looked at was linking freight to traditional planning. And one of the things that, you know, came to the top of that kind of right away is that freight is a contact sport, and everything that we think we know is changing at a pretty fast rate, and you really need to take a proactive position in trying to understand what the freight trends are and how those challenges and changes might affect your specific region. For example, today we're looking at diesel fuel in the range of $5 a gallon. And how might that impact not only the number of truck trips, but also the distribution activity in your region? As nationally, we go from an average of 3 to 5 distribution centers for many of the largest customers. We're looking at potentially expanding that to 6 to 12 distribution centers just to recognize the fact that the fuel costs have increased so much. So if that happens, how does that impact your region? And these were some of the kinds of questions that we asked the different constituents to help us with in the interview. So if we look at the most successful examples, the linkages came from trying to understand what the freight strategy is, particularly with respect to your region and how do you fit in a national program with respect to freight and freight movement, and then highlighting freight projects within TIPS. and identifying the key freight corridors and facilities that are driving the activity within the region. The guidebook provides help and guidance on how to effectively integrate the freight within the existing process, and we've come up with several different strategies to look at that. Freight data is often the Achilles heel in any one of these types of projects, and I think the difficulty is because much of this data is viewed as proprietary, particularly at the private sector level. And yet it is incredibly important to be able to identify what the impact is of a specific transportation improvement project, not only for the local economy, but to help justify the cost of the project. And I think that the private sector, at least what we identified in the interviews, is beginning to realize that this is a full contact sport, and that in order to help system performance improve on an overall level, there needs to be collaboration and some partnership. So one of the things that we saw is that many companies, if you can develop trust and a good relationship, particularly with the local freight stakeholders in the region, are more than happy to share issues that they're struggling with and provide data if there is some linkage to help come to a positive resolution in this area. I think we are making strides in this area. I think this is one of the areas that probably is going to represent the slowest level of improvement that we see. Identifying the gaps and understanding how we might be able to put together specific infrastructure fixes, for example, being able to time signals, being able to put in left-hand turn lanes, being able to help speed freight or show private sector exactly how a transportation improvement might impact their freight volume and velocity goes a long way to helping bring the private sector to the table and being able to help them share data with a specific project in mind. From an outreach perspective, that was probably one of the most difficult and probably the most interesting piece, is how do you get the private sector to become interested in understanding and working together with not only the state but the MPO on identifying transportation improvement programs. One group was very creative and put together an open call for freight projects and tried to get this message out to both trade associations and the private sector within their region through Chamber of Commerce efforts, as well as through different business alliances, and tried to actively engage the private sector to come up with ideas and suggestions for freight projects. Many of the MPOs and many of the state DOT planners have had to begin the process in what seems to be often a very slow way, but to do on-site interviews with specific private sector freight stakeholders within their region or within their key areas where they know that there are significant transportation activities. I think one of the biggest difficulties that we identified here is that, and this is old news for most of you, but that most of the private sector is looking for relatively short-term improvements and is looking at a planning horizon of roughly 5 years, whereas the public sector is looking at long-range projects that might take 10 to 20 years to actually implement. One example might be the Detroit Intermodal Freight Facility, which has been in the planning stage now for well over 10 years. They are making great progress now, but it has been a project that has been on the books and has been a very long time in coming. And it's been very hard, kind of across the board, for state MPOs, MPOs and state DOTs to keep the private sector engaged on many of these projects that have such a long duration. So I think the identification of milestones and being able to show progress kind of along the line during these larger projects is another very helpful approach to achieving effective outreach and to be able to get the private sector to participate. One example that we identified in the interview process was sort of the red zone approach. And this was in a very large community, very large urban area is probably a better way to capsulize this, that several of the key freight stakeholders that had significant transportation interests basically had the direct telephone contact to a specific member within the MPO. So when they started running into transportation issues and difficulties, they would give them a phone call and discuss the problem sort of immediately to try to at least get that on the radar screen. I realize that that may not be the best for long-range planning, but at least it was a method of connecting the private sector with a planner to help identify and target where specific choke points at different times of the day were happening. Multi-jurisdictional approaches are very important too. Another area that we identified was that it was often hard to quantify benefits, particularly over a long corridor. When we think about the nature of freight, freight usually does not originate and terminate in the same local region, but it has certain metrics associated with each mode, and what originates or terminates or passes through a specific jurisdiction or community may have a significant impact on the local traffic flow as well as congestion and overall highway performance in that region. And so to understand where the freight is going to and coming from and where these choke points and where some of these other bottlenecks are occurring and helping understand and quantifying the benefits are very critical in order to being able to implement a project. There are a number of freight training and education opportunities. On this slide, we've listed several. I think the important part is to recognize that any profile or any guidebook that gets put together needs to recognize that there's a lot of existing information available today in the form of case studies as well as reference guides through AASHTO, through TRB, through the NCFRP program, as well as the NCHRP program. As well as a number of different case studies are available and resources are available through the TRB committees that might have specific relationship to either freight or to specific regions. One of the things that was identified as a very good tool or a mechanism to not only engage the private sector but also to heighten the awareness of freight and freight planning was the availability of workshops. Several workshops, at least in different regions, had been held to try to help educate and provide a face for the freight transportation problems that are being experienced in a specific region. And some of these workshops actually had agendas that had working groups and breakout sessions where they brought not only the public sector, but the private sector and the MPO agencies and other regional and local planners together to try to brainstorm some quick hit improvements or some opportunities to gain some relief for some of the problems that they were seeing locally. Advocacy is the last element that we'll talk about in terms of the seven key elements for freight planning and integrating into the transportation plan. One of the things that is very difficult that we've recognized kind of throughout the process is that freight is often considered as a private sector problem. While we see it in terms of on the highway, it's often hard to identify exactly where the freight is originating, where it's going to, and why it happens to be at a certain given place at a certain time. Again, advocating freight and being able to articulate the benefits of great transportation improvement projects need to be able to be communicated at the highest level of the organization so that we can create champions and advocates, for example, within the state DOTs as well as within the MPOs, to help highlight and articulate the importance of the project. One of the interviews that I was specifically involved with was with the Chicago area, and one of the key elements that they identified for being able to get the Chicago CREATE project through was the advocacy and the leadership of their top officials that were very committed to the process. Recognizing that the process is still underway and that these processes often take a very long time to come to fruition, being able to have a champion and a leader that helps keep the constituents engaged and helps deliver the message not only to those that are going to be associated with funding the project, but those that are in the process of developing the project is very important and very critical. For more information on the guidebook and the process, we have put together the link to the website, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at the end.
Well, thank you. I should also mention that the guidebook is available for download in PDF format on the in the file share box in the bottom right corner of your screen. So, thank you, Libby. We're now going to move on to Richard Martinko of the University of Toledo. So, Rich, you can go ahead when you're ready.
All right. Thank you very much. Certainly, it's my pleasure to be with you all today, and thank you for your taking your time to participate with us here today. I'd like to talk about a particular case study that I'm aware of in Ohio and that we've struggled with at the DOT, plus now worked with at the university. I'd like to just frame the argument a bit about why freight is so important to Ohio. Within a one-day's truck trip, which is about a 600-mile radius, a 600-mile diameter, 300-mile radius, Ohio's got about 50% of the United States population, 60% of the manufacturing capacity, and also 50% of the Canadian population. It's really the 35th largest state geographically. It's a rather small state, but as you can see, it's got a very robust transportation network as far as interstates, volume of truck traffic, really 13% by value of all freight traveling in the United States touches Ohio's transportation system. So freight and freight planning for Ohio is very important. There's a conflict, however, between maintaining the existing infrastructure and planning for new freight modes, intermodal modes, and expansion of freight opportunities. Pretty clear when you look at indicators as to how Ohio's economy grows. As the gross state product of Ohio grows, it pretty much tracks along the same slope as truck VMT, and that's been true for a number of years. It's probably true for a number of you in your states also. Ohio recognized that and revised their macro corridor plan to include routes that relieve freight congestion and routes that had high freight growths. Project selection-wise, here's some typical examples of how Ohio does project selection. They have what's called a Transportation Review Advisory Committee. It's called TRAC. It's being revised right now, presently under the new administration, but in principle, it allocates points to particular criteria, such as transportation and safety. All that data is put into a formula. There's a track council that's made up of non-ODOT people. They're made up of business people and community leaders from around the state. And 70% of the scoring is done through transportation and safety, 30% through economic development, and extra points are given for local or private participation, the modal impacts, and anything that's involved in herbal revitalization. Projects are scored, ranked, and then funded accordingly. If a project is worthy but funding is not available because it doesn't score high enough, it drops down to what's called a Tier 2 level. And that's the process that Ohio uses to determine major projects. The freight projects typically that are going on right now, there's a grade separation program that the governor put in place. I think it was a $10 million 10-year program. There are presently 30 grade separation projects that are involved. There's a Wilmington bypass that involves a major air freight company. Route 24 runs from Indiana to the Port of Toledo. We call it Fort to Port, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's got 40% or 50% trucks on a two-lane road. That project is being done. That's probably about a $110 million project. There's a US 20 widening, Cuyahoga River Valley. There's some urban corridor projects, but the one I want to focus on as a real-world example and some of the struggles that ODOT and Ohio had is the Rickenbacker Intermodal Air Freight Project. That came online in March of 2008. It's complete project is a huge project. The first phase was about 175-acre intermodal yard, and I believe that was probably about $68 to $70 million for that yard. The key element that ODOT struggled with wasn't that the project was not worthy, not valid, but who pays for the project, and does anybody really care where the money comes from? From the public's point of view, I'm not sure. I wanted to throw those issues out there. I'm certainly not advocating any one point of view, but you know what we end up with is the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that's what the DOT struggled with in trying to make this tipping point decision. The project, every track project has a project sponsor. This one was sponsored by the Columbus Regional Airport Authority, and Norfolk Southern was a partner. Their existing intermodal facility was over capacity, and future predictions obviously show that 140,000 lifts at over capacity and the need for 243,000 lifts by 2015 is going to make the present intermodal facility grossly under capacity. Limited Brands is in Columbus. So there's some major economic drivers that are located in Columbus, and this intermodal yard was extremely important to economics for Ohio. It's also part of Norfolk and Southern's Heartland Corridor initiative, and I'll show you a map there. If I could click on the green. That starts at the Port of Virginia and obviously moves east. There's an area here in West Virginia, and there's 28 tunnels that require some major rehabilitation off to Columbus and to Chicago. Now, that shaves off a considerable 1031 miles to 1264 the way the existing route moves up towards Harrisburg. So there was a specific savings for Norfolk and Southern in this Heartland Corridor. The Rickenbacker Logistics Park is right there in the yellow box. It's really an integrated logistics park. It's going to be built in stages. You see the orange box is the intermodal terminal. It's 300 acres, of which 175 is developed. There's going to be a campus for intermodalism, an air cargo campus, north campus for business development, and then also a rail campus. As you can see in the bullet items, it's really Norfolk and Southern's first integrated logistics park. It's very close to downtown Columbus. There's a tremendous opportunity with 15,000 acres for project development. That's really where most of the money's made in the ancillary things that develop around an intermodal yard. Most of the jobs created by an intermodal yard are in the neighborhood of 100 to 140 jobs or so. But when you start developing ancillary businesses for the parts that the intermodal facility carries, you get distributors, you get warehouses, and so there's a real leveraging of effect there. That's the layout of the intermodal yard. Not that that's critical, but you know, it's a typical intermodal yard with a, you know, with an unloading track and then storage area. What's important with this slide is this is NS's, Norfolk and Southern's, business revenue mix. And as you can see, intermodalism is very close to the largest share of their revenues. And the reason I pull that slice out is it factors into what decision the DOT makes based on what level of participation the railroad puts into the project. Rickenbacker Port Authority, in their application for this project, asked for, well, I'll call it $50 million in ODOT funds. The railroad was only going to match $10 million, which is why I showed that slice of 21%, a huge percentage of the revenue, but they were only matching $10 million of the project and asking for $50 million from the DOT. Now, they cited benefits which are normally associated with congestion mitigation and intermodalism, such as air quality, reduced highway congestion, and economic development. Unfortunately, to build on what Libby was talking about, as far as data, there wasn't a whole lot of data put forth to support those benefits, nor was this project run through the TIP process or the MPO. It was kind of a project that the Port Authority at the airport and the railroad wanted to get through the DOT process. Now, the good, obviously, the economic benefits of this project, as it was laid out and proposed, you can read them. Major shipping cost savings, truck miles reduction, significant reduction of emissions, and then over the next 30 years of operation, there's a claim of 9,500 direct jobs, 10,900 indirect jobs, additional square footage for building development, building construction, machinery and equipment. So there's a whole lot of economic benefits, as I said earlier, associated with an intermodal yard. How good are these numbers? How clearly developed are they? How supportive was the data? It was rather, I think it was a black box. These were the numbers that were presented. Not sure how clear it was that these actual benefits will take place. The bad part was, as far as ODOT's initial response, was you're asking for 75% of public funds for a private beneficiary. How can ODOT, without real hard data, determine the real need of Norfolk and Southern, especially when you claim that this is one of the most highly profitable parts of your business? If the project can't pay for itself, why is it a good project? Why should the public pay for highway funds to be diverted to one company and not to a publicly shared project? Transportation benefits, they're there, but they're probably not the primary benefit of the project. Obviously, economic development is great. We support that, especially here at the Intermodal Institute, but the DOT, in struggling with infrastructure funds and how to allocate money, those were the decisions that they were trying to make in order to reach the tipping point about that project. If the DOT sets a precedent, how does it respond to other private companies that ask for the same thing? And as I said, the immediate job creation was only about 140 jobs. All the rest is projected into the future. And then as far as points for local and other financial contributions, this was really the DOT and the money that they were asking for through the track process and a $10 million match with NS. There wasn't a whole lot of local involvement in this thing. the question was, what's the highest use for public dollars? With most of the DOTs trying to maintain their infrastructure, this is an example of a situation in Columbus where at the I-70 and I-71 split, it's got about 800 crashes annually, and they're trying to do a major reconstruction of that systems interchange, and it's nowhere near able to be completely funded. And here we have an opportunity cost of $49 million that could be diverted to other uses that are really semi-private. So they struggled with that decision. What happened was that the Port Authority changed its funding request then. They said, well, just fund the connector road that gets to the airport. And ODOT did approve that and programmed an $8.2 million improvement to the infrastructure that would move towards the airport. Now, the ugly was, where's the rest of the money come from? What happened was there was a march for earmarks. Now, I don't know how many DOTs felt. I do know that the ODOT DOT felt that the primary source of funding keeps getting bled off by earmarks. And since Ohio has such a robust transportation system, the formulas used to determine the money that Ohio gets from the primary funding source, Ohio usually gets a pretty good fair share, but if you keep bleeding off that primary source for earmarks, your percentage of that primary source, even though it stays the same, you get a smaller and smaller amount of money. So the earmark issue is one that a lot of DOTs struggle with, and eventually, though, through Safety Lou, the project did get a $30.4 million earmark, and the key policy questions that I guess I'm bringing up here for the group to consider is, you know, what are the public transportation benefits of a private project? Is economic development a valid purpose for federal aid funding? Public investment in a rail intermodal facility, is that a superior alternative to known existing alternative transportation investments, especially with the infrastructure problem that most DOTs are having? The benefits, again, there's transportation benefits. There's a shift from truck traffic to intermodal traffic. Of course, the reduction in VMT, road maintenance costs, theoretically there should be some. There also should be a benefit for safety, and there should also be an air quality benefit. Without any data, ODOT cranked a few numbers and said, well, the VMT that would be reduced by this project in Franklin County, which is the county that Columbus is in, is 912,500 VMT miles. Now, the annual VMT truck travel in Franklin County is 438 million miles. But that was a reduction of less than 1%, 0.2%. Though on the downside, an intermodal facility may increase VMT through urbanized areas, and because it wasn't an acclimated project through the MPO or the TIP process, there wasn't a whole lot of public involvement in it, and there may be a not in my backyard uprising. Road maintenance costs, because they were too small to measure. Here's the environmental piece of this puzzle that the DOT put together as far as VOC, NOx, and defined particular emission, even those, when you take a look at the regional emissions versus the reduction, those again were fractions of 1% of production. So aside from the economic benefits, the other claimed transportation benefits and the claimed air quality benefits were relatively small. So the ugly issues, again, still remain. You know, the Title 23 earmarks don't fit very well for intermodal projects. It appeared that the air quality benefits were minimal. The VMT, that was open to debate. As I said before, there was little data to really make a hard decision. And it was wasn't in the long range transportation improvement plan or the MPO's plan. So that was an issue. Now, the contracting and maintenance, what I mean by that, what ODOT meant was this project was going to be funded by an earmark, but the railroad was going to manage and construct the project. The typical DOT oversight with change orders, record keeping, investigation, things that are in Section 646 that the DOTs have to comply with, were really non-existent for this project. The railroad was actually going to construct the project. And that, I think, needs to be looked at in the long run as far as where and how DOTs and governmental entities participate in these public-private partnerships. There needs to be a new approach. We've got to get the railroads involved to give the public some answers. We've got to provide data. Need to participate in the long-range planning process for the DOTs and the MPO, and then maybe acknowledge some public contracting constraints and some oversight in projects like this to make sure that there's value for the money. We need to encourage, like I said, more private beneficiaries, get some better public use. Now, some of the people were talking earlier about other things such as grade separations, traffic lights. Those are all great things to do. The MPO process, we want to get some local funding involved. Let's identify the public benefits a little better. And then the private sector investment, I think, needs to be beefed up. So where are we? In the sunset of this new intermodal frontier, right now there's few regulations that fit this frontier. My opinion, we need a flexible sheriff that needs to bring law and order to it. Railroads, the states, and the FHWA have got to all compromise and bend. And the new regulations got to reflect the new conditions and the new wildlife on this frontier. And that concludes what I wanted to bring to the table and the questions that I wanted to put out there. Like I said, I'm not taking any stance as to what the right answer is, but those are the questions I think need to be answered.
Thank you, Rich. Again, I encourage everybody to post any questions for Rich or any of the presenters to the chat area, and we'll get to those after this final presentation, which is going to be given jointly by Steve Devine of the Rhode Island Department of Transportation and Catherine Chapani of Rhode Island Statewide Planning. So, Steve and Catherine, you can go ahead when you're ready.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. And before I get started, I just have a technical question for Jennifer. If I have slide animation, do I click the mouse or click on the arrow?
Continue clicking on the arrows, and that should bring the animation up.
Okay. All right. I'm going to talk first about the planning process, and then I will turn it over to Steve Devine, and he's going to talk about a quite extraordinary project in Rhode Island. I know what you're all thinking. Rhode Island is such a puny state, and this land mass shows not even all of New York and New England, and there we are. And we're 1,000 square miles, 1,500 if you include Narragansett Bay, and we are painfully aware of our small size. We are often used as a yardstick to measure the size of forest fires, cattle ranches, and ice shelves. And but small can also be an advantage, and our small size allows us to have a very efficient and unique planning process. My office is a statewide planning agency within the Department of Administration, and it's also the single statewide MPO. The State Planning Council, which is our MPO board, has no elected officials, and that is fairly unique. All 39 cities and towns in Rhode Island are required to have comprehensive plans, and those comprehensive plans are reviewed for consistency with our state guide plan, which is 28 different elements. The cornerstone of our transportation planning process is our Transportation Advisory Committee. We call the TAC. We meet monthly in the evening, The TAC has 26 members, including state and local officials, members of the public, and non-government organizations, and our freight advocates include the construction industry, the trucking association, and economic development. And I'd like to talk a little bit about our TIP. And this process works when we actually have money and we have room in the TIP for new projects, which was not the case in the development of our 2009-12 TIP. But in past years, when we have done our project solicitations, we reach out, we cast a pretty wide net, and we ask cities and towns for their project proposals, state agencies, members of the public, and also transportation providers. The criteria that we use to evaluate the projects, there are six here. It's a 120-point scale. Each one of these is worth 20 points. And so we score them on their mobility, cost-effectiveness, environmental impact, economic impact, consistency with state and local plans, and safety, security, and technology. Each one of these criteria have 6 to 8 sub-criteria, and I will spare you the excruciating detail on that. But if there is a negative impact in any one of these, project can get negative points for that. Our TAC members are split up into regional subcommittees, and they are the ones who actually score the projects. The way the criteria is set up, it does work for all modes, and the more typical projects are highway projects that come from cities and towns, but this also has worked for a bike path project that was proposed by a member of the public, and also a rail project that was proposed by our local freight railroad, the Providence and Worcester. And to be fair, the PNW did propose 2 projects in the last solicitation. One was for several million dollars, and the other one was for a few hundred thousand, and they did get the less expensive one. Our long-range planning effort that we did in 2004 had a very intense focus group process, and I have 2 of our 6 focus groups listed here. The Freight and Northeast Corridor Group, we were able to get FedEx, Amtrak, Providence and Worcester, and the Port of Providence to participate. And we discussed things such as capacity on the Northeast Corridor and so forth. And the second focus group, Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, we got our emergency management people involved, as well as the state police, the trucking association, the Coast Guard, the ITS community, and our bridge and turnpike authority. And we talked about such issues as hazmat and bridge clearances. And I think that we were successful in getting good participation because we only asked for a commitment for 3 meetings from each of these people. Another effort that we finished in 2006 was the freight planning needs assessment, and realizing what our staff and budget limitations are, what can and should we be doing as part of our freight planning program. And these activities that we've listed are ongoing, and we have areas where we would like to improve and do better on. And that last bullet, we do have a designated point of contact. Walter Slocum is a member of the statewide planning staff, and he is our freight coordinator. And before I finish, I just like to let you know all the documents that I've talked about are on our website, although the TIP and plan will soon be replaced with the new versions. But this is my last slide, and I will now hand off to Steve Devine, and he's going to talk about a project that was born out of the electrification of the Northeast Corridor.
Thank you, Catherine. And as Catherine mentioned when she began her presentation, this project, locally known as the Freight Rail Improvement Project, or the FRIP, was quite a unique challenge to DOT, Rhode Island DOT, primarily our Highway and Bridge Infrastructure Department. At the time when this started, the years on such issues as track design, construction, being on the Amtrak Northeast Corridor, indemnification and liability issues, which continue to, I'll say, haunt us today as we look to expand commuter rail out on the corridor, and also other railroad operational issues. While this graphic you see to your left may not be not the best quality, trying to get my arrow here. There we go. Just to give you a lay of the land, this is basically the Providence metropolitan area up to the north here is the Rhode Island Mass state line. The Freight Rail Improvement Project is a 22-mile project area that extends from what we call Boston Switch, which is located in Central Falls, Rhode Island, right at the Mass line, moving south through the Pawtucket Providence area into down through downtown Providence, and working south by TF Green Airport in Warwick, Rhode Island, and ultimately extending down to Davisville and Quonset. Davisville and Quonset was a former U.S. Navy base that is now a thriving port and industrial and business park, and a major major employer and traffic generator in the state of Rhode Island. The project itself included 12 miles of brand new track along Amtrak's main line in Rhode Island. For those of you unfamiliar with the Northeast Corridor, this is their main line from Boston to Washington, D.C. It is electrified. Trains can travel up to 150 miles per hour. As a matter of fact, in the bottom of the graphic there, where you see the Northeast Corridor, and that is one of the rare places where it is tangent track and straight, and they do travel up to 150 miles per hour through the state. So integrating higher and wider freight presented a challenge in mixing with 150 mile per hour Amtrak trains, in addition to our own commuter rail trains that we have planned for south of Providence. Project also included 5 miles of upgraded track north of Providence to the Mass line, which already had a separate freight track, but we upgraded to today's standards. And the project is a middle 5 miles where we share track with Amtrak on their main lines. Because of historical and other environmental issues, we were not able to provide a separate track through the East Greenwich area. And we share the track with Amtrak. In that 5 mile territory, many bridges had to be raised and a lot of undercutting of track had to take place in order to accommodate the freight trains. Funding for this project was a mixture. It was primarily back in the late 90s was FRA 50-50 funding for track rehabilitation, and that was mostly on the track that did already exist north of Providence to the Mass line. It was 50 FRA and 50% state matching funds, which the voters of Rhode Island overwhelmingly approved back in the late 90s in a bond referendum. We also used considerable federal highway funds for the planning, the environmental impact statement, the design, and a lot of the bridge clearance work, whether it was rehabbing a bridge, raising it, undercutting, was through the use of federal highway funds. Again, state matching funds were provided both for the 50% for FRA and the 20% for federal highway. And we also used a unique funding mechanism that we've recently employed on some major projects here in Rhode Island, and that's through the Garvey process, where we're essentially upfronting federal funds in order to advance some critical major projects in the state, and this was considered a critical project due to its economic importance and keeping freight rail competitive, which gets into my next slide here. You see a couple of photos on the left-hand side. If you look closely, you can see the electrification system for Amtrak. Amtrak's two main lines are to the far left, and the new freight track is in the middle of that photo there. On the bottom photo, it's to the left with the new concrete ties. Everything built for the FRIP was up to Amtrak standards, which adds considerable cost to projects. Unlike dealing with freight-owned lines, Amtrak line is definitely a unique situation. For those of you not on the Northeast Corridor, we have
concrete ties, and which coincidentally made it very attractive for other types of rail service, particularly commuter rail service, which I'll get into in a second. But this provided operational flexibility for the freights. It separated them from Amtrak's high-speed rail. When high-speed rail was introduced through the Northeast Corridor, levels of service increased dramatically. Right now, there's approximately 34 round trips per day up and down the corridor between Boston and Washington, and Amtrak anticipates that to increase to about 52 over the next 10 years, I believe. So there's a definite need. There was a definite need for this project. And again, as I mentioned, it provided us at DOT an opportunity to look at it for its benefits for commuter rail. I think long term we're looking at this as probably the start of, or maybe the first segment of ultimately an expansion of the Northeast Corridor from Boston to New York, at least through Mass, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. This could be a first segment of a third track. The photo you see on the left hand side is an MBTA. MBTA is the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority that provides commuter rail service in the Boston area. We've been under contract with them since 1988 to provide commuter rail service linking Providence and Boston, which is about 50 miles. It's about an hour train ride. The photo you see to the left there is a train passing by the Rhode Island State House into Providence train station. The graphic on the right is the new planned train station and consolidated rental car facility being planned for TF Green Airport. The airport's on the far right. The facility's on the left, connected by a skywalk and moving sidewalks. So that's a major component to our transportation. Providing transportation to an ever-increasingly congested corridor south of Providence along I-95. But in conclusion, the freight track provided extensive flexibility, not only for freight. There's obvious passenger benefits to this project, which we, Rhode Island DOT, specifically since we pay for 100% of it, which is total about $200 million project, we intend on taking advantage of. And as the one of the biggest markets down there at West Davidsville Quonset is the auto carriers, and the port continues to grow, significantly increasing car carriers that would have been on trucks and being hauled on our highway system are now being hauled by freight rail along this freight track, along the Northeast Corridor to points west through Massachusetts. So it's been a very successful project for us, and one that we look to continue expansion in the future. And I think that concludes Rhode Island's presentation, and Catherine and I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have as we conclude the webinar. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.